And continuing our exploration of the similes for the aggregates. Suppose that a magician or a magician's apprentice would display a magical illusion at a crossroads. One with good sight would inspect it, ponder it, and carefully investigate it, and it would appear to be void, hollow, insubstantial. For what substance could there be in a magical illusion? So too, whatever kind of consciousness there is, whether past, future, or present, internal or external, gross or subtle, inferior or superior, far or near. One inspects it, ponders it, and carefully investigates it, and it would appear to be void, hollow, insubstantial. For what substance could there be in consciousness? So this simile of the magic show for consciousness. So just reflecting a little bit again, kind of unpacking the simile a little bit. A magician. One of the key things a magician does is to draw attention away from where the illusion is created, so that it's not seen and it is believed or interpreted in a way the mind goes, oh, that's amazing how he saw that person in half and put them back together. And so this the magician works by creating this kind of barrier to what you see because of kind of a skill with drawing the attention elsewhere. We don't see where the illusion is created. And I think this to me speaks somewhat to the depth of the processes of mind being in very natural ways and in helpful ways many times, being below the level of our conscious awareness. We don't see how the mind weaves together experience into a coherent whole. A magical illusion also composed of small, little things that create the illusion, often weaving it together into an overall experience. And this flavor of, this is kind of my understanding around consciousness. The Buddhist teachings talk about six kinds of consciousness: seeing consciousness, hearing consciousness, smelling consciousness, taste consciousness, touch consciousness. And each consciousness arises in dependence on its respective sense. So dependent on the eye and sight, eye consciousness arises. Dependent on the ear and sound, ear consciousness arises. So this dependence on the sense base and the object meeting it, consciousness comes in. And yet, our experience is not one of these discrete streams of experience, usually. We experience kind of a whole. And so, m- my eyes seeing that wall, having experienced the sight of walls many times, and having experienced through touch, contact of the hardness of walls many times. In some way, the mind weaves these together. And in my system, I kind of, you know, if I envision running really fast towards that wall, there's something in my being that like doesn't want to do that. It understands the sight of the wall and the rapid approach of that side of the wall is going to lead to impact and pain, kind of weaving together the understanding of these different senses. It's like, there's not so much of a distinction in the mind between these sense impressions. The mind weaves everything together in a way. And I think of potentially, especially the mind consciousness as being this weaver, weaving all of these sense impressions together. Because all of the consciousnesses, so seeing consciousness, hearing consciousness, smell consciousness, taste consciousness, those are all mental activities. And mind consciousness, weaving them together into a kind of a coherent experience. And so beginning to see or get familiar with this experience or the process, really the process of knowing, the process of consciousness. And so a few reminders about what we talked about with respect to consciousness the other day. Every experience. So there's sight, sound, smell, taste, touch. Those are all comprised of a consciousness. So every object that we experience, every sight, every sound, every smell, every taste, every touch, comes with a knowing of it. And so there's the sight, the form, the color, and then there's the mind that knows it. And these two come together. They're so close, so closely connected. And yet it is possible to recognize or kind of see the difference between these two sides of the experience. Not so possible necessarily to tease them apart and see them separately, see the knowing as separate from the object, because the object depends on the knowing and the knowing depends on the object. This is the description in the suttas. One place it describes these coming together. And the description is that the Buddha's understanding or reflection around consciousness and body and mind experience, he's said to have reflected. So what does consciousness arise in dependence on? It arises in dependence on the sense bases, the body and mind, basically. So consciousness actually arising in dependence in a way on the way it's framed is that there's in the five aggregates we have consciousness and then the other four aggregates, body, feeling, perception, mental formations. And the teaching is that these four arise in dependence, or consciousness arises in dependence on these four. So consciousness arises in dependence on body, form, feeling, perception, and mental formations. And then he's said to have reflected further. And so if consciousness arises in dependence on these, on body, form, feeling, perception, mental formations. What do these arise in dependence on? And he said to have come to the recognition, oh, they arise in dependence on consciousness. And he gave the analogy, it's as if there's two sheaves of wheat propping each other up. They can stand propped up, these two sheaves of wheat. But as soon as you take one away, if you take this one away, this one will fall down. If you take this one away, this one will fall down. So they are mutually supportive, mutually dependent in terms of standing. And this is kind of the sense with the mind, the knowing, and the object of knowing. They can't be separated. And yet, mindfulness can understand the different nature of knowing from the nature of the object. Oh, it might, it's kind of like you might I'm going to use a gesture here. You don't have to open your eyes, but it might make it make more sense. So the object and the knowing together arising. And in terms of understanding the difference or the kind of different kind of aspects of the knowing from the object, it's like sometimes the mindfulness kind of can look at it from this side and know something more about the object. But we need the knowing to know that. I mean, so it's like it's not that the knowing disappears here, but we can kind of incline towards knowing this side of the experience. And likewise, we can also incline to this side and know something more about the knowing, the process of knowing, what that experience or what that is. Again, the object doesn't disappear. In fact, the object in some ways illuminates the consciousness. And so mindfulness can know either side of the experience. We've been exploring a lot, and kind of the most, one of the most natural ways that our minds work, is to recognize the objects. And even recognizing mindfulness and the functioning of mindfulness is recognizing a mental formation. How awareness works, the broad, the narrow, all of that, that's all mental formation. So that's still, from the perspective of knowing, that's still object. The knowing illuminates these aspects of the awareness of the mindfulness, whether it's narrow or broad or flowing or popping. And so mostly we're familiar with recognizing the object itself, the flavors of the object. And so it's a little more subtle to recognize the knowing itself, or to taste the flavor of that. We can perhaps begin to explore this. A couple of ways that I've explored this in my own practice, in my own experience, in the physical experience, we might begin to be able to touch into the difference between seeing and the knowing of seeing, hearing and the knowing of hearing. So there's the sight and the knowing of it, the sound and the knowing of it. Taste and the knowing of it. Joseph Goldstein has encouraged a kind of a passive voice as a, almost a, it's almost like a reflection that might help us to touch into the knowing side of the equation in these experiences. And he has encouraged, as we're exploring or noticing sight or sound, so there's the automatic kind of recognition of the hearing, and then a kind of a reminder or a reflection. And so this is investigation, again, remembering investigation with a really light touch here. Just a little kind of dropping in of the recognition that there's the hearing, and that hearing is known. There's seeing. And seeing is known. And the encouraged actually using that kind of a mental reflection. And for me, bringing in, it's like bringing in a little bit of wisdom to remind the mind that the knowing is operating. And it may begin to help the mind to begin to recognize the process or that aspect or that side of the experience, the knowing side of the experience. So seeing is known. Hearing is known. Tasting is known. And then another way that's been interesting in my own experience has been in exploring the mental realm, the difference between aversion and the knowing of aversion, love and the knowing of love, confusion and the knowing of confusion. And so there's the recognition of, oh, right, aversion is happening. And that's got a particular quality to it. We recognize perhaps the unpleasant quality of the aversion, the tightness. We may understand something about the leaning away from all of this being aspects of recognizing the aversion itself. And for myself, this exploration around the knowing has been the first time it really began to be clear to me that the mind was recognizing the knowing side was when the mind was observing reactive emotion. So aversion happening. There's physical unpleasant sensation in the body. There was aversion. There was a recognition of the unpleasantness of the aversion, the unpleasantness of the physical sensation. So all of this was experienced. And then at some point, and this, again, this wasn't a kind of a doing, but at some point the mind kind of oriented or kind of got interested in, well, this aversion is happening and it's known. Aversion is known. And when the mind kind of got curious about aversion being known, there was a distinct shift in the quality of the experience. And instead of being unpleasant, it became neutral. And the reflection in the mind was, oh, the knowing of aversion is neutral. Of course, knowing is neutral. It's just like this reflection of what's happening. And so that exploration around recognizing the aversion and then inclining or kind of being curious about the knowing of aversion. In that case, it had the attention shift from this side to this side. And the quality that became so distinctly different was the feeling tone. Because the feeling tone of the aversion itself was unpleasant. The feeling tone of the knowing was neutral. And so that was kind of an indication to me that the mind was seeing the knowing. I didn't really know what the knowing was really at that point, or, you know, really how to describe it or anything. But the mind understood it was kind of landing in a different side of the experience. So I want to come back for just a moment to the mutual dependence of consciousness and its object, because this is really a piece of the insubstantiality of consciousness. It arises in dependence on conditions. It's not somehow separate, kind of a continual consciousness that's present, and then things are coming in and out of that consciousness, at least in the understanding of the Buddhist teaching. Consciousness arises with the experience, with the object, and passes away with the object, and another consciousness arises, and another consciousness passes away, and another consciousness arises, and another consciousness passes away. And the so this insubstantiality of consciousness, not a stable background from which experience kind of arises, or into which experience arises. The analogy of the magic show is described in the commentaries like this. Consciousness gives the impression that a person comes and goes, stands and sits, with the same mind, but the mind is different in each of these activities. This is not something we normally recognize or attune to. Some of you have actually been describing this in the meetings, that, like, wow, what you know, this mind here, and, you know, 10 minutes ago, or even like 2 minutes ago, it was like a different mind. Which mind is me? It's this flux. And so the sheaves of wheat analogy, that consciousness arises in dependence on form, feeling, perception, mental formations, and mental formations, feeling, perception, form arise in dependence on consciousness. The one way to kind of touch into this dependency through analogy, for me, this came really through an analogy, a visual analogy that I experienced on one retreat. I've described this, so some of you have heard this, but it was up at Cloud Mountain, and I was at Cloud Mountain for the month of January, sitting a self-retreat in a little cabin they have at the top of the hill, and a very private area. It's got a little courtyard that's fenced in with lots of trees. It's right in the middle of the forest, so trees like over shading mostly. It's in shade most of the day. And I guess I could say I was fortunate enough to be there during a major winter storm. We had 8 inches of snow in a very short time. And then following that, it stayed below freezing for days. And so the snow, which it was very dry, and so the snow was really light and fluffy. You know, I would go out each day and I'd like check and see, had it melted at all? I'd blow a little bit and it would just go poof. So the snow was really light. And for days it was cold and didn't go above freezing. And the snow just stayed this really light, fluffy texture. And then one day, finally, I think it was 4 days later, the sun came out. It still stayed below freezing, but the sun came out. And so for days, the trees, all the evergreen trees, had been draped with this snow, this beautiful snow. And it hadn't moved, you know. It hadn't been windy. It had been cold. And so it had just hung on these trees, and this dense, you know, 8 inches of snow hanging on these trees. And then the sun finally came out and started like warming the tops of the trees. And as I walked through the forest, I would hear these, you know, the snow falling as it was warmed by the sun. And then every now and then, walking in the woods, I would see this burst of light as the snow would fall through a patch of sunlight coming through the leaves. And you can kind of see through, you know, the air. You can kind of sometimes see the light streaming through the trees. And then as the snow fell, you saw the glitter of the snow. It kind of just illuminated that, the light coming through the trees illuminated the snow falling in a very beautiful way. So the light illuminating the snow. And then a day later or so, I was looking out into the courtyard at my little cabin, and covered with trees, so there was no light visible in the courtyard. You know, it's like, apparently looked like there was too many trees above to see any light in the courtyard. But I was sitting there just kind of in that seeing mode, just kind of eyes kind of soft, and I heard some of this falling, and a whole bit of snow kind of fell right in the courtyard, right in front of me. And as it fell, it illuminated, or the snow falling revealed these streams of light coming through the courtyard. And it startled me, because it was kind of like, I didn't know that light was there. There was no evidence of the light. No, like, dust in the air that was revealing there was light in the air. No spots of light anywhere that I could see. But I was standing on a deck, and so I was curious, and I kind of peered over the edge of the deck. And there were some small spots of light under, you know, the sun landing under the deck. And in that experience, what happened for me was that the snow, rather than the light illuminating the glistening of the snow, in this case, the snowfall illuminated the light. And then as the snow finished, it's like light is gone. No sign of light at all. And it happened a few times. I actually got my phone out. I took a video of it. You know, just the, as it would fall, you'd see these like waves of the snow falling, and then see this light just kind of bursting into appearance. And that image became a meditation simile for me around consciousness and the object, because it was such a kind of a vivid example of how, in this case, the object illuminated the light. We don't think of it that way usually. Usually the light illuminates the object. And this kind of dependency is what happens. So sometimes the arising, the object illuminates the knowing. Sometimes the knowing illuminates the object, but sometimes the object illuminates the knowing. And in this way, the kind of, you know, aversion is known. It's like the knowing isn't so obvious, but the object is revealing the presence of the knowing. oh, the aversion is known. And we can maybe taste or touch that flavor of knowing. So we tend to attribute some kind of stability to knowing, consciousness. There's one sutta in which a monk is saying that he is interpreting or feeling like the same consciousness, just like this description, the same consciousness is going through life. And in fact, he's saying the same consciousness is going to appear in the next, is going to be in the next life. There's no change, that this consciousness is stable and enduring and lasting forever. And the Buddha says, basically, foolish person, when have I ever taught that there's this stability to consciousness? Consciousness arises, and he gives a teaching again on the dependence of, and this is where the sheaves of wheat, I think this is where the sheaves of wheat simile comes in. It's like consciousness arises in dependence on the object. The object arises in dependence on consciousness. Not stable, not enduring. So this, all of these aggregates have this kind of deceiving, or prone, let's say prone to processes of the mind that make us attribute stability, permanence, lastingness to them. The analogies kind of point to the ways that that happens. And there are processes of the mind that seem to be responsible for this delusion, this deceiving process. There's one in particular described, a deceiving, deluding influence in the mind, a force in the mind that's described connected to this whole process of the aggregates and how we know experience. And this process, this diluting process, is called papancha. Most of you have heard of this, I'm sure. As I was reflecting on this yesterday with Diana, reflecting on the magic show and the magician and reflecting on the papancha, I said, oh yeah, papancha is like the magician's wand. It's weaving the illusion of stability into being. So the texts don't really give a clear definition of papancha, but they describe how it works in the mind. And so I'll just go through this this teaching. And as I go through it, recognizing each of the aggregates called out here, each of the aggregates in the formation of our experience, each of the aggregates is named. So this particular teaching, many of you have heard this, the Honeyball Sutta, describes this process of the creation of experience and the weaving of papancha and delusion with respect to the six sense bases. And so we'll just do it, I'll just read it with respect to the eye first. But it's repeated with respect to the ear, the nose, the tongue, etc. So, dependent on the eye and forms, eye consciousness arises. So right there, we've got form, the eye is form, the color, what's out there, the light, the photons hitting the eye, that's form. So dependent on the eye and forms, so that's the form aggregate, eye consciousness arises. So the consciousness aggregate. dependent on the I and forms, I consciousness arises. The meeting of the three is contact. With contact as condition, there is feeling. The feeling aggregate. So, sight happens. Feeling arises. Pleasant, unpleasant, neutral. With contact as condition, there is feeling. What one feels, that one perceives. The perception aggregate coming in. Recognizing what is seen. Maybe at a bare level, blue, round. Maybe a little more detail, hydrangea. Dependent on the I and forms, I consciousness arises. The meeting of the three is contact. With contact as condition, there is feeling. With feeling as condition, there is, with what one feels, that one perceives. Sorry. With contact as condition, there is feeling. What one feels, that one perceives. And so this is the bare kind of piece of our experience. The sense base, consciousness, feeling, perception. This is kind of the bare kind of, the bare is part of our experience. And then our mental formations get involved. What one perceives, that one thinks about. You start thinking about hydrangeas. Start wondering, why is that one so blue? The one in my yard is more purple. What one perceives, that one thinks about. This may happen with or without mindfulness. Even just the recognition of hydrangea is a form of thought, in a way. And so there, you know, so thought. The thought itself is kind of innocent in a way, often. You know, it's not, we can know this with mindfulness. The thinking can be there with mindfulness, but often is not. So what one perceives, that one thinks about. So one recognizes it as hydrangea and maybe a little bit of thinking about hydrangea. And then what one thinks about, that one mentally proliferates. This again is mental formation. So thinking is mental formation. This proliferation is mental formation. This proliferation is the translation of the term papancha, this mental proliferation. That one mentally proliferates. So this, the interpretation of what this means, this mental proliferation, at times it is understood and taught about as meaning lots of thinking. You know, we start thinking about the hydrangea, and then the mind just kind of runs amok, thinking about where can I get a hydrangea, and you know, where can I plant it in my yard, and what kind of treatment to the soil do I need to make it blue instead of purple, and the mind just kind of gets like charges out and just loses mindfulness. This is one way in which papancha is understood, as kind of the mind running riot, lost in thought. And this, seeing this process, actually, this happens a lot to us. We perceive something, don't notice the thinking, and don't notice the kind of hook to the thinking, and then we're gone. So this is an interesting way to begin to see that one of the ways the mind slips out of mindfulness. When we perceive something and recognize it, that recognition process of, oh, hydrangea, a form of thought almost, is that recognition. And that is so tantalizing to continue thinking about. So that's one way that the mind kind of gets lost. And the mind getting lost in thought is a form of delusion. A form, it's like we are in the world of our mental creation. One of you described this and how amazing it is to see the mind believing those imaginings. You know, how real they seem in the mind. This is delusion at work. And then the text goes on to talk about how that proliferation then, it doesn't just stop with proliferating, and we've seen this, you know, so this is mental formation, right? This proliferation is mental formation. It's not just thinking that proliferates, it's also whole, like, emotional baggage that gets pulled in, remembering, arguing with a friend over hydrangeas, and maybe emotion gets pulled in there, and this is shaping the mind. This papancha, this the mind running amok here, it's shaping the mind. And as it shapes the mind, we then, with what one has mentally proliferated as the source, perceptions and ideas born of mental proliferation beset one with respect to past, future, and present forms cognizable through the eye. Now that's a little complex, that phrase, but basically my understanding of what that means is that the shaping quality of the mental formations that are kind of running amok with the papancha are shaping our minds. One of you reported today the kind of the seeing of how a mind shaped by one experience, that it kind of then applied that shaping to everything else. This is what it's pointing to, that when we experience something, so this kind of deluding influence of the mind, we experience something and have a view and an emotional kind of package arise in the mind, that becomes the frame through which we see experience. That to me is what this means, that we the mind creates a filter based on experience and then applies that filter to everything else. And so this definition of papancha as being the mind running amok, lots of thinking, is one way to understand what this papancha is. And yet there seems to be a deeper deluding magic wanding around papancha that's more subtle than simply lots of thought. Because in the suttas, the description of a mind without papancha, it's given the word this nipapancha, is said to be very close to freedom. And reflecting on that in my own, reflecting on that, it's like, well, freedom is a lot more than just not thinking. We can slip into places where we're not thinking through concentration. So that can happen. But we're still clinging. We're still kind of identified, potentially. And so some scholars have explored alternative translations for this term rather than mental proliferation. Tanisaro Bhikkhu in particular has looked at the term around papancha and kind of a creation that he has understood or describes, at least, that it's applied in terms of the creation of themes in art. And so, there's like, if you have a painting, there may be some resonance from place to place to place to place, and that would be like a papancha, the creation and restating of a theme. Or in music, a particular phrase that repeats. We kind of maybe like it's a little hook. We hook into that, and it's like we recognize that little phrase of music, and that being Papancha in the music. And so Tanisaro Bhikkhu points to, this is like the creation of a theme almost. And he has translated Papancha as objectification, the creation of an object. And so this kind of is one of the ways other translators, other scholars, Jnanananda in particular, Tanisaro Bhikkhu, point to this process of Papancha as potentially being connected with this, the deceiving influence of the mind that takes concepts to be reality. That takes the perception and reifies it as substance. This is a very subtle kind of process in the mind, and it's connected very much with processes that are functional for our mind. You know, the stability of perception as we look around, as we navigate our lives. And the actual, what's coming into my retina here as I turn and look is not stable. At times I have, in meditation, entered into these places where it's really simply form and color coming in, and that's what's experienced. The mind is perceiving in that way without the concepts or overlays of objects. And it's like, I would not want to walk across the room just seeing form and color. So it's really useful to have this stabilizing of concept. And yet it's misunderstood, and we've talked about this several times in the last few days, misunderstood as being the actuality of experience, that it is stable, that it is reliable, that it is, we are meeting what's out there. And actually what we're meeting is what's constructed by our minds and our mind's capacity to stabilize with concept. And so the part of the process that's problematic is not the stabilization, but the believing the concept to be what's actually there and not recognizing the construction of the mind. This really, to me, points to the magic show. Our experience is a magic show. And largely we are deceived into believing the reality of what we are seeing as being what's out there and not recognizing the forces of views and beliefs and opinions that are actually shaping the experience of the magic show. And so recognizing, beginning to understand that it is a magic show. It's like there's times where we might kind of almost have this multi-layered experience of understanding that this is entirely constructed by the mind and yet able to navigate. It's this interesting, like, experience of seeing that the mind can stabilize and yet knowing it's a construct of the mind, not being deceived into believing that what this mind is knowing is actually out there. And so this very strong tendency for the mind to believe its perceptions, its experience of this magic show as real. One scholar, wait, before I get to that, I'll point to the term objectification that Tanisaro Bhikkhu brings up also points to something else in this process of the mind creating and solidifying around that exists, that object, that creation of object. With the creation of object comes the creation of subject. So with the creation of that out there comes a me here. So this is a simultaneous process of creation of other and self. Same process at work. We've talked, I think, a little bit in this room around noticing othering. And sometimes our mind is oriented around, you know, I, me. That's pretty obvious in terms of a sense of selfing. But also we can be oriented around they, them, that person doing that thing, they should be, they shouldn't be, they, them. We can be associated with that. With they, them comes an I, me. With even the attribution of thing, water bottle, comes an I separate from that water bottle. So that process of papancha, or that objectification process, this process by which our mind divides up the world into objects and self, this is a very powerful piece of that magic show. And we so thoroughly believe not only that there are objects out there, but that I am here knowing them. And the aspect, a kind of, because this is a deluding factor in the mind, this objectification, this creation of object and subject, and that what we are experiencing is in the mind, it's very easy for views, opinions, perceptions, and views, opinions, agendas to influence our experience of that object. We don't experience objects in a very neutral way. We experience them in independence on our views and opinions and ideas. One scholar puts it this way. This process of distorted perception, of placing every bare perception into a framework of emotions and beliefs that have come out of our past, our history, our conditioning, robs the freshness out of our experience. But we are not aware of this constant interference of the past. And I'd say also of the future, because the idea, so the past is nothing more than a concept, an idea, a thought arising in the mind. This was the past, and also all of the kind of way we've been shaped in the past. But not only are we shaped by the past, we are shaped by what we think will happen in the future. We are not aware of this constant interference of the past. Because of this unawareness, which is our ignorance or our delusion, we see humanity as fragmented into me and others, us and them, and in various other stereotypes, skin color, ethnicity, language, ideology included. And so this process of this, you know, this useful process of stabilizing gets misunderstood, taken to be truth. And the truth of the objects is also conflated with our views and ideas and beliefs about that. It's not only that we are taking this to be a person here, but this is a person with certain body type and certain skin color and certain gender and all of our like views and opinions about those ideas are kind of brought in to that relationship. So much suffering happens because this is not seen as being a process. I'll read a little piece of a text where the Buddha's pointing to this, kind of the way we tend to divide and create, you know, different people, or you know how we kind of tend to create these distinctions between people. And he starts by saying, you know, there are distinctions in beings. There are many kinds of birth. And he goes through, you know, there's grass and trees and they lack self-awareness. But this birth is their distinctive mark. And then there are those beings that walk on 4 feet and small and large. And they have a distinctive mark of birth. And then there are the fish swimming in the ocean. And that's their distinctive mark. And he goes on, many different kinds of beings. And he says, with humans, no differences of birth make a distinctive mark in them, nor in the hairs, nor the head, nor the ears, nor the eyes, nor in the mouth, nor the nose, nor the lips, nor the brows, nor in the shoulders, or the neck, nor in the belly, or the back, nor the buttocks, nor the breast, nor the genitals, or ways of mating, nor in the hands, nor the feet, nor the fingers, or the nails, nor in the knees, nor the thighs, nor in their color, or in their voice. Here birth makes no distinctive mark, as with the other kinds of birth. The other kinds of birth have distinctive marks between them. In humans, birth makes no distinctive mark. In human bodies and in themselves, nothing distinctive can be found. Distinction among human beings is purely verbal designation. It's concept. For name and clan are assigned as mere designations in the world, originating in conventions. They are assigned here and there. For those who do not know this fact, wrong views have long underlain their hearts. Suffering comes from this misunderstanding, concepts taken to be reality. And so externally, this magic show misinterpretation creates so much suffering in our relationships. And internally too, this taking our experience to be what's actually there, misinterpreting it as stable, worthy of clinging to. That kind of magic show of stability, the mind interprets it as worthy of clinging to, and it is not stable. And so the clinging creates the suffering as the instability reveals itself. And I'll close with a quote from Thich Nhat Hanh. For things to reveal themselves to us, we need to be ready to abandon our views about them. Let's sit for a moment.